My name is John. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, John.
Now I get a chance. Lock the doors. You know, it's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous that everybody likes to be just a little bit different. And if you listen to everybody commenting how many days and months and sobriety that they had tonight, almost everybody had it a little different. And when I was coming in this evening, or yesterday, I was noticing some of those beautiful signs that were showing where we have this conference. And there was one that really got my attention. It was the joke about the Alaskans, the Eskimos. And I want you to know my name is John Carney, and I'm 46 days and 11 months sober, 11 hours sober. Because that's the way it is if you have at one day being 6 months at a time. So I'm ahead of you, and I'm different. And I'm also damn tired of people encouraging me because I'm following such a sensational speaker that we had this morning. And if you missed it, I'm grateful. I introduced myself as an alcoholic because I found that out when I came into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not know any of that information, and I am sober this evening by the grace of a loving God and a meddling member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I walked into my first meeting, and I have to tell you something happened, but it really happened before that, and it's one of the things that seems to be apparent to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, that we're surrounded by miracles that happen, and one of the unfortunate parts about miracles is you just don't know about it when it's happening. I was sitting in a saloon doing what good people do who are sitting in saloons, sucking in a little bit of Jack Daniels, and some meddling member of Alcoholics Anonymous who had not heard some of the rules that we have in AA about how long you have to be sober before you screw up somebody's life. This kid had 5 days when he walked in hot from an AA meeting, full of fire and vinegar, and sat down beside me and ordered a Coke, which is the most disgusting thing anybody could order sitting in a saloon. And then he proceeded to tell me about you. And I thought that was disgusting. He also said I would like you, and I knew that was a lie. I did not like anybody, particularly the person I was. And when he asked me to come to an AA meeting, my mouth betrayed me, and a miracle happened. And I said yes. I didn't want to say yes. I wanted to tell him very forcefully to get out, but he was too big. Now, the miracle happened then. And the miracle happened this way. I was in the process of drinking my fourth drink, as best I remember. And I said yes. And this was on a Thursday night. And I wasn't planning on going to work the next day because I was about to do some drinking. And I said yes and slid that drink back. And I haven't had one from that moment to this. And that. I really can't say that without getting a chill up my spine, because that was on the 11th of March, 1976. And my sobriety date is the 12th of March, 1976, which equates in Eskimo times to exactly 46 days and 11 hours. It's a challenge to figure it out. I'm ahead of you, so I'm smarter. I am delighted to be here, and I want to thank the people for inviting me and my lovely bride to come here. We always enjoy having an opportunity of doing the best we can to spread the message of recovery. Because I have to tell you, as I started with this thing, is that from the moment I walked into my first AA meeting to this very second, the quality of my life has gotten better and better and better. And it changed that night when I said yes and I meant no. And I followed up by going to the AA meeting. Now, my debut, if you would, in Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't too awesome. The first person I met insulted me, and I wanted to leave. He walked up to me, and he said, "Oh, so you have a problem with alcohol." And I said, "Well, hell, doesn't anybody, everybody?" And that guy said no. I wanted to kill him. He didn't understand my humor. But I was riding with this great big dude who asked me to go to a meeting, and I was unwilling to walk home, so I stayed to the AA meeting. And in that meeting, somebody said something, and they said this. Now, I don't know what you're going to hear when I say it, but I know what I heard when I heard it. It said that somebody stood up and said that I would never have to drink again as long as I live if I didn't want to. And what I heard was that I had drank for 30 years. If he was true, when this person said this, I had drank for 30 years because I had to. The concept of doing without alcohol, frankly, at that time, didn't have any meaning to me. But if you were telling me the truth and you were not lying to me, you were saying that all of my drinking and all of the life that I had lived, it was because I had to, that I suffered from a disease. And that would have revolutionized and destroyed any and everything that I knew about me or believed that I knew about me. And I was curious and mad. I was so mad at you that I decided I'd come back at you. And so my friend asked me, that was on a Tuesday night that I went to my first AA meeting. The following Friday, he asked me to go to another meeting. And I said, I don't want to go back where those people are. They're rude and uncouth, and they laugh at the wrong things. He said, no, we'll go to a different place. And I said, okay, and I went in his car again. And the people were quite much nicer than that first group. It's surprising. Different side of town, obviously. They were a little more cultivated, and they appreciated my wit. My friend called me up on the following Tuesday and asked me if you wanted to go to another meeting. And I said, back to that place? And he said, yes. And I said, well, okay. So I walked into that same room on Tuesday night, following Tuesday night. And it's amazing how much better those people got in the course of a week. They were friendly and they were outgoing and they treated me very properly. My friend called me up on a Friday, the following Friday, and asked me to go to an AA meeting, and I said I was looking forward to it. I called my friend up on Saturday and asked him if he wanted to go to a meeting, and he didn't want to. And I had to go to my first meeting all alone. Something happened to me, and I realized something had happened, and it was a big thing. I just didn't know what had happened, another one of those things that happened. I think I know now is that somewhere in those first 2 weeks of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, you touched my soul, and it awakened just a little bit. And I got a thirst, and the thirst that I had was for what you had, and I wanted it. I wanted it if it were true. I wanted it. At that particular time, I had selected a man to be my sponsor because I was told that you had to have a sponsor. This dude stood up in an AA meeting at that time and said that he would not sponsor anybody who had less than 90 days of sobriety. And that meant I had to wait. I was incapable of asking questions. I was incapable of talking to you. Because I didn't belong here, you have to understand that I've been an outcast all of my life, or I believe that I had been. Remember that I tell you these stories, that it's all predicated upon the knowledge of a man who came in here living a life for 30 years, thinking I drank for the reason that it made me feel better, that it was too hot and I could cool off, or I was too cold and I would warm up. I was too sleepy so I could get an eye opener, and I was too awake so I could get to sleep. I was too hungry and I had to kill my appetite. I wasn't hungry, I'd have to have some to get wet my appetite. The great panacea of all things, it solved all problems, called alcohol. And you were telling me, God damn it, I had to drink that crap because I had to, and that infuriated me. You know, my wife, when I walked home from my first meeting, I had a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was curious, as I said, I was curious about you, and I started reading that book. That woman of mine looked at me and said, you're an alcoholic. And she said, oh, you'll never have to drink again. Hell, I didn't know what she was talking about. I did not know, nor had I committed, that I was interested in being sober. And after a very short period of time, as I said, my soul was awakened by you touching me. And I started doing things to prepare myself for when I was able to ask my sponsor to be my sponsor. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous was my target, and it said that if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take the steps. And so I had to determine, I thought there was some sort of a test that you were going to give me. I'd walk up and say, will you be my sponsor? And then he'd say, well, this is the test. This is what you have to become willing to do to in order to stay sober for good and for all. So what are they? And I had to get ready for it because I didn't know. You had a secret society. I kept thinking at the very beginning that somebody would once said to me in my first meeting, he said, come to the next meeting and we'll tell you where the secret is. And so I kept going to find out what the secret was. And it was always at the other meeting, not the meeting I was at. But I started to uncover a little bit about the information about me. You see, in all of this information I should have had, I know I should have had, but I didn't have. It's inconceivable to me, hardly, almost inconceivable to me to think that I did the things that I did without knowing what I know today. An alcoholic is an ugly thing when they're in their cups. And to rationalize and justify that and not realize that there's something seriously wrong indicates the depth of the disease of alcoholism and how, in true fact, that the problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind, not his body. Our morning speaker said something that triggered a memory of mine, and it's a memory of when I was a little four-year-old boy. I think I was four. I might have been five. It's the earliest recollection that I have of an event in my life. My father was a drunk. My last name is Carney. One of my brothers did a research on the Carney family tree. And he went back to seven generations, and he found that no male Carney has ever lived past the age of 55. That's kind of impressive, but he didn't tell me that until after I was sober. That means that every one of my Carney clan, the male side of our clan, died of alcoholism, war, or accidents. Thank God I got sober at 48. But it shows you how this thing's going. But I was telling the story about the little four or five-year-old, I don't know. As I say, it's my earliest recollection. My dad was a drunk, and when he was a drunk, and when he did come home, he was a periodic like I, but he was a binge drinker. When he got drunk, he'd be gone for months at a time. But when he did show up, he always wanted to have a fight, and he wanted to fight with us. I came from a large family. I was the youngest child at that time. And he always wanted to fight with my mother, and all of us kids would pitch in trying to save our mother from the damage that my father might cause. And this was one of those days, and I can remember holding onto my father's foot, trying to keep him from tackling him, I guess. I'm not too sure what the hell is a little 4 or 5-year-old, though. And I don't remember anything about that other than shortly after that I'm in a vacant lot, and I'm singing to myself and saying this. It's one of those things I carried and I didn't know I had it. I was saying this, one day I'm going to grow up and I'm going to be rich and famous and everything's going to be okay. Now, I didn't know at 4 or 5 what rich meant. And I didn't know really what famous meant. But it would be somebody that's perhaps in the mind of the little boy, somebody very important. And I'm going to be okay. Now, that's one of those little themes that seem to be part of my life. That's what I tried to do. Well, I've had moments of fame. I remember when I picked up my first drink in Alcoholics, my first drink of alcohol. I was in the Army. And I happened to be fairly well known because I was a boxer. I had just won the state title for the Golden Gloves in Texas. Oh. In Fort Bliss, Texas, as a matter of fact, which is not one of my favorite places. No offense, you understand. But they wanted to celebrate, and so a whole bunch of people found out I had never drank, so they took me to the Green Frog, bought a couple of bottles of Green Frog in El Paso, and bought a bunch of whiskey, and tested me with it. And I found out after sampling just about everything they had that I liked the effect. And I found out after all of the mixes they gave me, the thing I liked most of all was straight bourbon whiskey. And so that's the way I started drinking. I could encapsulate, you might say, all of my drinking in the first 10 years of my life. I was learning how to put ice in my bourbon. Second 10 years of life, I wanted to become a sophisticated drunk. The second 10 years, I was learning how to put a splash of soda in it, so I really had class. And the last 30 years or 10 years was spent enjoying my drinking, but it's not the way it was. I learned everything I needed to know about the disease of alcoholism my first night out. I got drunk. I made an absolute total ass of myself, most of which was reported to me afterwards because I wasn't there. I got in a fight. Some people got hurt, and it wasn't me. I woke up sicker than a dog, and everybody told me what I had a wonderful time, and we'll have to do it again. And since I was a hero upon the camp, we did it again, and again, and again. So you can say that I drank, and I learned everything I needed to know on my first night out, and I spent 30 years gathering useless information. I didn't learn a damn thing. I did not learn a thing. I'm one of those who married my high school sweetheart. Just to give you a small background, you see, I really just wanted to grow up and be rich and famous, and everything's going to be okay. I love my mother and I love my family, and I was trying to be a nice little boy. My mother always said what a nice little boy I was. I didn't turn out very nice when I was a teenager, but I was a nice little boy. It's Mama's little boy. Jackie, I was named. Hated it. Now, that's not information you really need. But what the hell? I'm standing here and you're sitting there, so you got to listen to what I have to say. And sometimes it will be important, so you have to pay attention. And I'm not too sure what's going to be important, so you better pick it out. Anyway, I married my high school sweetheart, which changed my life. I was kind of a ruffian, and I won't bother you with any of that details. But she was pregnant with my oldest little girl. And when my child was born, I was all caught up in love. I was overwhelmed with what had happened. And I vowed by all that was within me that I was going to be the best damn father and the best husband that God ever gave to another woman. And I became a businessman, and I had enjoyed moderate success. Moderate success. I was pretty successful. And around 11 years later, after drinking, the more successful I got, the more I drank, and that's just the way it is. I don't know about you, but once again, my career of drinking, where in the world did we get the name drinking career? As if that's some big deal. I was a slob for 30 years drinking it, and I called it a career. I'm going to elevate it. I get class now. Okay. Don't you call me a drunk. It's my drinking career. I'm different, don't you know? Anyway, around 11 years later, I'm a big wheel in a steel company in Southern California. I got the life before me and a big future and a branch office that is all mine, and I've got 5 little girls, and I came to on a running drunk, and I hear a voice on the telephone telling me that my wife had just committed suicide. And I don't know a great deal about that, other than there was apparently 4 firemen, 2 policemen, and a bunch of plainclothes civilians that were insisting that I should sit down when I wanted to stand up. And after a great deal of damage caused by an awful lot of people and an awful lot of people got hurt, I wound up being choked to death or almost choked, insensible, and put into a straitjacket and coming to in the psychiatric wing of the Los Angeles General Hospital. And I will remember this day because it's important to me. It was the pain and the agony of the absolute conviction that I was the most evil man that has ever existed on the face of this earth. My wife was dead, and I had 5 little girls that I adored, and I did not know whether they were alive or dead or anything about them. And I'm laying on this gurney, and I'm strapped down, and I'm bleeding from a lot of different places because they were rude when they were dealing with me. And they were discussing, I came to, and they were discussing whether it was safe to let me go because they had to sew me up. I had a lot of stitches that need to be taken, apparently. And I remember the doctor peering down upon me and looking in my face, and he said to me, "If I let you loose, will you hurt me?" And I couldn't answer him. because I didn't know. I had just hurt the one person in the world that I loved more than anything else. I had destroyed my life, and I couldn't answer the question because I didn't know. I could have said, yeah, I don't think so. Yeah, I don't want to, what I could have told him. I didn't want to. I never wanted to do that, but I did. So I'm in a nut house. And I got five little girls, and I had to know where in the hell they were at. While I was in the nut house, the company I was working for, that I was such a big wheel at, sent word in that I was fired because I gave them the wrong image of the corporate structure. And when I finally got out, and I might add, as a typical alcoholic, without further need of psychiatric care, I was as loony as you can possibly get. I walk out and I'd see you on the street and I'd say, if you were where I was, you wouldn't get out because you're crazy. You wouldn't get out. Here, all you people are nuts. I'm the only sane one there is. I was in Southern California, as they say, and I was blackballed. I remember going, I was blackballed in my trade. I was very well known in Southern California. I went to a company that had been trying to hire me for many, many years, and I walked in and I said, Bill, here I am. He said, yeah, John, I know you're looking for a job. And I said, yes. And he said, well, John, I got one for you. I'll make a position for you. You just come back in a week, and it'll all be set for you. And I said, thank God, because I got five little girls, and I don't know what the hell's going to happen. Because my girls were okay. They were scattered through my house, or through my family. I have had a large family. And so I came back the following morning, Monday morning, to bright and shiny to work. Although I didn't want to work, I had children, as they say, to take care of because I've already been a failure as a father. I'm going to damn well be a better father this time because I surely screwed up being a husband. And he said, John, I'm sorry to tell you this, but I can't hire you because I have them. There's 62 employees. It was a big company then. It's a little one now. He said, I got 62 employees, and they all signed this position. They will resign if you come to work for them. And I tried all of the other businesses in Southern California, and they could not hire me. I was blackballed. So I carefully, with this keen alcoholic mind of mine, I figured out what the problem was. Southern California. So I moved to Northern California. And I became the best damn father that there was. You could have asked me. I learned how to cook. I was one of these macho dudes that used to brag I couldn't boil water without burning it. I learned how to cook, shop, iron. This is back when they, before wash and wear. All my little girls had frilly, beautiful dresses. And you ironed them. Now, I've heard my mother and my sister say that the ironing is a dreadful job. You stand over that hot iron and you've got to iron for hours and hours and hours. And with this keen alcoholic mind of mine, I decided that I would learn how to iron sitting down. Now, if you do that, you have to be ambidextrous. Iron left-handed and right-handed, and I got pretty damn good at that. Now, my oldest little girl had a dress that was, she was a doll in this thing. It was a brown peasant dress with white lace, ribbon, rose, a white yoke, and a white puff sleeves, and it was just gorgeous. And I would do all, I'd come home from work, and I would do all of the work as far as cleaning, giving the kids their baths, and telling them stories, and putting the bed, cooking dinner, of course, and then I'd do all the housework when they were asleep. They get asleep, and I'd open up the Jack Daniels and have a drink or two, a small libation, you understand, because it's a dreary task of sitting there ironing these things. And I was ironing my daughter's dress, and I scorched the lace. And I looked at it for a while, trying to figure out what I could do with this. I'd never seen scorched lace, because it was a brown dress, and all the lace was white, and it had this brown spot in it. And I figured out what I would do. So the next 2.5 hours was spent scorching all the rest of the lace to match. My daughter never appreciated that. So much so that little snot never wore that dress again. Could never understand it. But I was going on and totally convinced that I was still the best father that the world has ever known. I drinking occasionally, but I had to spend most. I was too busy with my kids to do an awful lot of drinking, because that just happened to be. If I had one obsession that was greater than my obsession to drink, was the fact that I had to take care of my kids, because I'd already screwed up so dreadfully. Anyway, I was a chief engineer for this company in South San Francisco when we moved to Northern California, and while I was a chief engineer of the company that had fired me while I was in the nut house, which I hated. Did you ever have a resentment? There's a sign in the Burbank Fellowship in Southern California that says, "Don't harbor resentments. Get even fast." I had my moment of fame, because the company I had fired me signed a contract to the new company that I was working for that required us to produce and manufacture all of their products of a certain type, and it was my division. They had 11 companies in the 11 western states, and they all had to come talk to me. And I knew every one of them. Every one of them. And they were all rotten. I took pleasure in telling them that. And one day I got a call from some young lady in the production control department, and she was cool. First human being I talked to in quite a long time for this company. And I enjoyed her conversation so much, and she seemed to know so much about everything, that I decided and told the executives of this corporation that I no longer would talk to any one of you bastards. If you want to talk to me, you go to the lady in production control and have her call me. And they had to, including the owner of this multi-million dollar corporation. They'd trot over to go see this little girl in production control and say, "Will you call John and ask him, please?" God, I was in heaven. I was absolutely in heaven. Anyway, this young lady and I got to spend an awful lot of time on the telephone. So much so that I thought she was so efficient, I decided to hire her. But I thought I had also find out what she really looked like. I had a number of my employees that worked at the company, and they told me about her, but they didn't describe her very well. And so I decided I would take her out for dinner one evening so we'd get acquainted. And she lived in some little dump in Berkeley, and I went over there, and I remember with great fondness, I knocked on the door, and some little gorgeous little blonde-headed girl come running down the steps in her nightie, torn. Mother didn't like her enough to mend her nighties like I would have done, because I so well. Then I looked up the stairs, narrow little stairs and straight up, and I look and see this woman that's larger than she should be. And with this keen mind of mine, I knew she wore falsies. Never mind the fact that she was up there looking down at the top of my bald head. Now, with that very auspicious beginning, we went out and had a wonderful time. I asked her for another date. That's when I found out it weren't falsies. Now, if you had the sense enough to have been at the meeting this afternoon and heard my wife, this saintly woman, doing such a magnificent pitch, you would understand why some of you are laughing harder than others. The true fact is she really did molest me. Oh, shame on you. You have no sympathy for me now. You said, oh, a little earlier. Anyway, and shortly thereafter, I asked her to marry me. We were shopping. I was showing her how to shop because she didn't know how to shop. Right between the peanut butter and the mayonnaise is when I proposed. And she said yes. And I said to her these words. Oh, they were so prophetic. I said to her this way. I said, my dear. That's not what I said. I said, stick with me, babe. And I'll take you places you've never gone. We'll do things you've never done, and we'll go places you've never been. God, what a prophet I am. Every year thereafter, I made less money. We moved up and down the state of California. I become unemployable in almost every area there is. Now, there's no offense to those of you who introduce yourself from Fresno. This is not offensive mode at all. It's just the state of mind of a poor, sick alcoholic. But I died in Fresno. Foreigners are not welcome in Fresno. All hell broke loose in Fresno. As a matter of fact, to show you how bad Fresno is, in my opinion, I took a drink in Fresno and came to in Chico. I came to in Chico and in a $5 a night motel. Stone naked, alone, and I sleep with pajamas. And I had purple stripes on my body, about this long, all over my body, where places I can't reach. And places where nobody else should have reached. And I'm feeling bad, and I'm looking in the mirror, and I said, oh my God, what am I going to do? Peg will never understand. Peggy is my wife's name. Thank God it showered off. It washed off. A number of years ago, I had the privilege of speaking in Chico. And I asked if the member present would remember the same night I remember to talk to me after the meeting, because I needed some more information. Now, that shows you that I have not a glorious drinking career. Stupid is the word. But quite honestly, in Fresno, all hell broke loose. And that's when Peggy announced that she was pregnant. And for those of you insiders and realized already, you know that I had a vasectomy. And she was medically incapable of conceiving. And we were pregnant. You know, that makes you think a little bit. And there are a number of bartenders in Fresno that fought with me. What happened in true fact is I had lost the battle and I knew it. I lost the business. I believe that I lost the respect of my wife. I certainly had lost any respect I had for myself. I had no faith in my ability to do anything other than eke out a lousy living in a rotten world that I didn't belong. To make enough money to give my kids a fair chance of life, and I was condemned to live. Because I certainly was not able to dispatch myself with one more baby on the way. And so there's a line in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that describes my plight and describes it very well. It says that we had but two alternatives. One is to go to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best you could. And that's what I was doing. Certainly doing the best I could with it, but blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation as best I could, because there was no other option. I did not know about the disease. I was infamous. I was useless. And I was incapable of doing the right thing. Here I had such bright ideas and so much, I had recovered so much, and here I married this magnificent woman. And we were starting out to conquer the world, and it was destroyed, and I knew it. I knew it. What had started out so well, and I knew that it was my fault. And all you can do is eke out a lousy living in a rotten universe in a world that you didn't want to fit into in the very first place. And that was me, 9 years before I got sober. When I hit the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, our marriage was an endurance contest. My children that I adored had all run away. I had my 8-year-old, which was the little boy, the pregnancy in Fresno, my last chance to be a decent father. That little boy was hiding in the other room when I'd come home. A little boy that adored me so much when he was just a tiny baby, and all the other children knew what an affection he had for me. And all the kids would say, "Daddy's home, Daddy's home," and the little boy, baby, thought my name was home. Oh, God, I loved that. This is the same little boy that was afraid to be in the same room with me. And the same man that started out so well that you could sometimes look at the door when it would open and you'd see your children come in the door and they'd glance around. And you might see their faces. And they would look to see you. And if they think you saw them, they were condemned to come in. They didn't want to come in. What a difference sobriety makes. Not long ago, two of my grandchildren came to visit us. Special little girls. They think my name is Grandfather Dear. That's what they call me. They opened up the door and they looked just like my other kids do, but with excitement in their eyes. And they look at me and they see me and they scream, "Grandfather Dear!" And they come running to hug me and love me. Everything that I ever wanted, I had. But I had lost it. And you gave it back to me when I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Things happened to me almost immediately. Talking about service, I got involved almost immediately. Things happened immediately. I was a couple of months sober. I changed almost from the gate because you had touched my soul. It was beyond anything I could do. I only would follow the directions that are clearly written in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous so I too could recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And it was happening to me right away. I was a couple months sober and I'm sitting in that same living room where the little boy was hiding in the other room. And I'm sitting in this living room and my wife had gone out somewhere and that little boy is in the same room with me. And I've got chills in my spine because he's not hiding from me. And I don't know what I was doing, reading a book or watching television, and I hear this little voice behind me say, "Daddy." "I love you." I would have paid a ransom to have earned that, and it was given to me because of you. I couldn't talk to you when I got here because I was afraid of you. But I started talking to my wife because you told me I could. You said that you could carry these principles to home, and I didn't know what the hell they were, but I'd practice them. First thing I heard, what a huge revolutionary change it occurred in my life. When I heard this thing, it says, "Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope." Now, I'm looking in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to find out what's necessary to go to any lengths. So I started reading this thing. And if you're interested in it, if you look to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous as I did, you will find there's a zillion things in there that say, these things you must do, become willing to do, or learn how to do in order to stay sober for good and for all. And that's what really any lengths is. And one of them is that we're men and women who share our experience, strength, and hope. I did not know how to share. I had to learn how to share. Can't share with you. You don't know what the hell I'm talking with. I'll go home and talk to my wife. So I started sharing. Now, I don't know what I said, but this is what I meant to say. I said, Peggy, I'm going to share. And this is what sharing is. I'm going to talk on a subject that is important to me. And I'm going to be as honest and as sincere as I know how to be. Your job is to sit, listen, and don't interrupt. And try to understand. Now, when I'm done, it's your turn. You can speak on my subject or a subject of your choosing. And my job is to sit, listen, don't interrupt, and try to understand. Now, I did the best I could, and I don't know how to share. It was unequal. She knew how to share. Oh, God, she would say the most rotten things to me. But the book trapped me again. Damn that book. It said, avoid retaliation. Practice the 10th step from the beginning. Self-restraint. Run, find somebody in a tree and tell them how she's abused you and told you about these rotten things that you are reputed to have done. And it always starts, do you remember when? And I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous because I qualified. Because I'm one of those I had to join. I did not have a God when I got here. I've been baptized to my count in 12 different religions. It didn't take. I had hands laid on me by Bishop Pike in the Episcopal religion when I joined the church when I married Peggy. We got married in the Episcopal church in Belmont. But it didn't take. I fell in love with the priest in Belmont, but not the church or the belief. And so you told me what to do. It started very simply in that one line, which is the great line. It says that if you now believe or are even willing to believe. And it goes on to say that if you admit that you're willing to believe, we can emphatically assure you that you're on your way. So our speaker this morning was talking about something that is written in my book. They said, you have to pray. And I didn't know how to pray. So I wrote down in my book to remind myself what I was doing, and I became willing to become willing, to become willing to pray, to learn how to pray. And so I started praying. I didn't know it at the time. I bought a book and started reading prayers. And they didn't write those prayers very well. And I started changing the prayers to suit my need. That's okay, because the book tells me I can do that. It says, very simply, on our third step, the wording is quite optional as long as we express it, voicing it without reservation. And I got permission to choose my own prayers. And I asked my God for help, and I got it. I was 4 months sober, and I just skip around a little bit because I have a keen alcoholic mind that walks in a devious path. And I haven't a hell of an idea where it's going to go. I fell to my knees one night after these praying. You see, I started praying to find a God that I did not know existed, nor was I overly sure that I wanted to find one. But I asked God for Him to reveal Himself to me, and He started to do that. And then I saw miracles. And I went to my father and said, wow, I'll tell you, I didn't know that. I guess you've been doing those things all of my life. And I've never recognized them before. And if you've got any more, please let me know about it. And I want to recognize it and give thanks to you for it. And he's been doing that ever since. And so I see an awful lot of miracles. I see miracles in flowers. And I see miracles in you. I see miracles in me. And I see miracles all along. And I fell to my knees one evening when everyone was asleep, because I'm still not talking very well. And I screamed to the God of my understanding, why me, why me, why me? Why have you given me so much? Why have you given me so much? An unfit, no good, uncivilized slob like me, why have you given me so much? And I heard, for those of you here this morning, you hear that Peggy was talking about God spoke to her. My God spoke to me. Very simply, he said, give it back. And I was up the rest of the night, and when Peggy got up, I told her about that. And I said, what'll I do? And she said, you better give it back. Now I'm 4 months sober, and I didn't know what to do, but you had a 12-step. So I went down to central office and said, I got to do 12-step work. And they said, you can't. You don't have a year of sobriety. And I said, but you don't know. I don't have a choice. I got to have 12-step call. So I hammered those people to death. And one day, I think they were trying to get even with me, they called up and said, John, we got a 12-step call for you. I said, wonderful. Where is it? Phone number. And they said, well, we got to tell you, he's got a gun. And I said, don't me. I'm on God's mission. It doesn't make any difference. I got his address, and I jumped in that car, and I started hauling down that highway, and I suddenly said, oh, my God. I've never been on a 12-step call in my life. I got the book. He's got a gun. What am I going to do? Fortunately, I by then knew how to pray. I said, Father, you're going to help me, or I'm in deep caca. Isn't that wonderful what God can do for you when you cannot do it for yourself? We read the book a little bit, and I took him to a hospital I did not know existed, and I checked him in a place, one of those, you know, $15,000 a week dry out centers or whatever the hell it was, and they didn't even ask if he had insurance. They said, does he have? And I said, I haven't got a clue, but I don't have any choice. You got him. He's here. And he's still sober. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? That's the grace of God working through in a God that I did not yet even know. I walk up to my wife and they say, these little vignettes are things that are important to me. I walk up to my wife and I said to her, she alluded to it earlier, with a P word, potential. I walked up to her and said, honey, I'm sorry, but I'm changing and I'm scared. And she said, what are you scared of? And I said, I'm changing so bad, I do not know what's going to happen to me. But I'm coming a different person and I don't want to screw it up because our marriage seems to be working so well and I don't know what's happening. But I can't stop it. And she said, don't worry, you're turning into the kind of man I always knew you were. Wow. Thank God I gave her fulfillment and brought her into Al-Anon. The kid probably would have never made it alone. I was a couple of months sober. Our first speaker was talking about something that happened to me in my second month. I think it was my second month of sobriety. I come running home. I remember, I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to Peggy. Because now we have learned how to share. And I come running home and I say, Peg, I feel funny. And she says, what happened? I said, nothing. Well, she said, well, what's happening? I say, I just feel funny. And she said, well, is it good or bad? I said, what's the feeling like? She said, I said, I don't know. I never felt this way. She said, is it a good feeling or a bad feeling? And I said, well, I think it's good, but I have no reason to feel good. She said, if you're going to call it something, what will you call it? And I thought a while and I said, impending good. I've had impending good. I have another disease called impending good. I still have it. It's better than impending doom. I'm told that when he takes something away, he gives you an equal and opposite. He took impending doom and gave me impending good. What a wonderful thing sobriety is. I prayed my way through the 12 steps of recovery. Now I know that's not true. It's not in the book. But I asked my father, don't do this. If you do it, duck. I was having difficulty understanding the disease, getting it from here, that 18-inch drop from here to here. And I couldn't understand, powerless over alcohol. intellectually I knew it, but it didn't get down here, and I knew down here is where it was, because you told me the great reality was down here, not up here. And the problem, the alcoholic centered in mind, not his body. And as I knew, I had to get it down out of my head, down into my heart. My heart was crunched up. My heart, I had squeezed it so much, I was trying to fight people out of my life. Despite the size of my family, I had no room for anybody. I taught my children, I love you because I had to love you, because you're mine, but not because I love you because I love you. And I had to drop it down, and so I asked my father to show me what I was powerless over. Like I say, I don't, particularly if you be newcomers, don't do it unless you're prepared to go to any lengths. Because I was sitting in a place when all hell broke loose. A place I should not have been. I was 4 months sober, a place where I should not have been. I was in a saloon with my wife and a bunch of people. I was overconfident. And suddenly that moment of clarity came across, and I knew it dropped from here to here. And I knew why it was my wife had to die. I knew why it was that I was unemployable. I knew why it was that I felt that I was a discarded human being and not fit to live when the good ones died. Why my children were afraid of me. Why my wife was hiding in the bedroom and I was collapsing in the couch in the living room. Why that wise, beautiful lady that I had married had turned into an ice queen. The marriage that had started out so blissfully and so wonderfully had been destroyed. It all dropped down, and I found out about it because God revealed it to me, because he answered my prayer. And I asked him to show me how I was trying to use my power that I did not have so I could understand more readily the second step, and he did. He gave it to me. I was catapulted from that. I was catapulted through the 12 steps of recovery. All hell broke loose in my life. My wife and I decided we were going to do a third step. She decided it. I'm still somewhat intimidated by the relationship she has with the God of her understanding. My third step was taken in the Santa Cruz Mountains. My wife, myself, one of our 17-year-old daughters, and my 8-year-old son. The man who brought me to my first AA meeting as a witness. And we found a glen beside the road up in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And we all got out. And we all stood in a circle with my friend and his bride sitting on a log as a witness. And I turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood it, my God. Peggy turned her will and her life over to the care of God as she understood her God. My daughter turned her will and her life over the care of God as she understood her God. And my 8-year-old son pulled on his mother's hands, arm, and said, "Mommy, will you do it for me?" And Peggy turned his life over to the care of God as she understood her God. His will be his business when his time has come. My son was born with a learning disability. We found it early. And so he had some fairly decent schooling. When I got sober, I had a lot of money. Didn't keep it very long, but I had a lot of money. After the meeting was over, after our third step was over, 2 weeks after that, the school district called and said, "Mrs. Carney, I would like you to come in and talk about your son, Daniel." And she went down there. And the teacher said, "Well, we do not know what's happening to Daniel, but it appears that he's no longer disabled." And so we went to the doctor, because he had been special education doctor, was giving him special medication. And he said, after examination, "We don't know what is happening, but it's probably a spontaneous remission. We do not know how long it is going to be, but he is no longer has a disability." Do you know I was broke then? I couldn't afford a damn thing. It did come back. His disability did come back several years later. And by then, I was making enough money to put him in a fine school, to give him the best damn education he possibly could have. God itself is doing for you what you cannot do for yourself. Isn't that amazing? No, it isn't. It's commonplace in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started out looking for a God of my very own. You told me I could find Him. You told me this. You said that the purpose of sobriety is for you to find a relationship with a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. It says in the book about the stories in the back of the book, which are commonly referred to as identification stories, but the book says that in the following stories where each in his own word from his own point of view will tell how they establish their relationship with God. Relationship with God. I had the great fortune of falling in love with a man by the name of Chuck Chamberlain. I had the absolute great fortune of spending some time with that man. I was mesmerized by his teachings. The first time I met this man, he also said, and I'll finish this thought before I go on, says this, he says, there's little hope of long-lasting sobriety unless you find a perfectly satisfactory relationship with a living God. Now, I thought God died and you had to die to go visit Him. Never entered my mind that there could be a power greater than myself alive and well. The book reminds me that's true. His great reality is deep within, and it's only there and only there that you find Him. I remember when I first met Chuck, he was an idol of mine. I had been listening to his tapes for an unbelievable amount of hours because the Palo Mesa retreat was just done. It's called A New Pair of Glasses now. But I was just unbelievable hours. And after the meeting, I'm a few months sober, and Peggy says, do you want to go meet him? And I haven't breathed for an hour. And she said, do you want to go meet him? And I said, no, I'm too shy. And she said, come on. And she grabbed me and drugged me over there. And she walked up to this guy, and this huge hero of mine that's bigger than all outdoors, and she put her arms around him. God damn, that woman did strange stuff like that. You know, yes, God, publicly humiliating me, it always has and always. And Chuck was finishing talking, and he turned around and he kissed her. And she kissed him back. And then she said, Chuck, you don't know me, but I've been sleeping with you for the last 4 months. And he said, pretty good, wasn't I? I have a God of my very own. He has done for me what I cannot do for myself. I was 2 years sober and I woke up in an AA meeting. Chuck also told me this, that if you work the steps for the purpose by which the steps are written for sobriety, the related disorders will take care of themselves. Now, I haven't done a damn thing. I haven't spent one half a second trying to fix my marriage, which was broken. I haven't spent a second doing that. Because I don't know how. I broke it. How in the hell do I know how to fix it? So I haven't spent a second doing that. I haven't done a thing to try and mend my relationship with my children other than make a 9-step call on each and every one of them. I was 2 years sober and I woke up in an AA meeting. I found that I had got lost within you, total and complete abandonment of self. And I woke up in this meeting and I realized that I was everything I ever wanted to be and had been for 2 years. I was a good father, a good citizen, a firebrand in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had quality and they loved me too. That broken heart, the one who was all crunched up into a rock, that was afraid to let anybody in, it opened up. And the capacity to love it enlarged. The longer you're sober, the greater the love you have. I didn't know that's possible for people like me. I was 5 years sober, and I suddenly realized I was 5 years sober. Good God! I was 10 years sober, and I found that I was truly loved by the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is really the only good life. I have done nothing for it. I take total and complete responsibility for each and everything that has ever happened to me before I got here. I can take no credit or anything for what happened. The book gives me this much credit. It said, some small measure I've made myself ready to receive same. I roared through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and God doing for me. I love to tell some of the stories about particularly the 8th and 9th step. I had a list. The reason I'm saying is Peg alluded to it earlier, and I'm just making you who didn't listen to her, shame on you. Peggy alluded to it. Is the fact that I roared through my steps and I had a list of my list on 8-step list and I knew what the hell I was going to do and God did for me what I could not do for myself. I drank for 30 years. I was no great big king. I didn't beat up a lot of people or anything like that. I did my share. But I finished them and it just almost poof! And I was kind of walked up to Peg and said, I'm done with my steps. She said, did you get them all? I said, yep, I got my entire 8th list all done. She said, I have a couple names for you. Now, I'm not pretending that I've done these things perfectly or right. Now, this is an example. The book says more will be revealed to you. It doesn't say who's going to reveal it to you. Now, if it's your Al-Anon wife that reveals it, pay attention. Now, this happened to be, we were in a bowling alley, and she was quite a bowler in those days. We were in a bowling alley, and she said, what about Chuck? Or what about David C., not Carney, David, another one. And I said, oh my God, he's not on my list. He should have been on my list. He had damaged my family, and I had loaded up a gun one day to go kill him. And he wasn't home. And I got him over the telephone, and I said, David, look over your shoulder for the rest of your life. If you do not see me first, you're dead. That he wasn't on my list. Now, he should have been on my list. Now, I know that, but once again, God will do for you. The book promises this. It'll happen if you lay yourself open to it. Don't fight the book. Let the book do it for you. Let the program do it for you. So we're at the bowling alley, and 15 minutes later, we're at home, and the telephone is ringing. And I pick up the telephone, and it's my daughter who's calling me. This is my oldest daughter who is now living in Nebraska. And she had never called me because she doesn't... Another story. She calls me now, Daddy, and she loves me. But she was on the phone and we chatted for a few minutes and I said, honey, do you ever know what happened to David C.? And she said, yes, Daddy, I knew. Why? And I told her that I owed him an amends on the 9th step. And she said, Daddy, I'm so glad. Just a minute, he's standing right beside me. That's what happened to me through the 12 steps of recovery. Humph! You, if you're ready, if you better be ready, if you're serious about this program, I'll tell you, can you imagine what my life would have been like if I'd said, screw him and hang up? No, thank you. I would not be prepared to that. I have a power greater than myself that solved my problems, and for that I am deeply, deeply grateful. Peggy announced that I'm having a wonderful time here. I don't know about you, but once again, Peggy announced that she this morning, about a year and a half ago, she came down with cancer. And that it has been a tough, tough time. Here I am, a man that was unfit, physically violent, but not with my family. And forgot how to smile. Had no ability to love. Chased my children out of my life. And she said, when the doctor gave us news after the first surgery, and said the cancer had spread, my first remark was, isn't it wonderful that we love each other as much as we do? And this last year and a half has been the most intimate mind-boggling deal that you would ever want to know. It is something that you could all miss very happily, but by the same token, it's been one of the most revealing, rewarding, loving, magnificent experiences of my entire life. Now, I don't know if this is what they mean about it, but there's a line in the book that says that if trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize on it to demonstrate His omnipotence. Now, I can't say I'm jumping up and down with joy, but we sure have one hell of a time, the lady and I. I had to come to you to find out that I, in true fact, had married the woman that I adore. She is everything I've ever wanted and more than I ever dreamed a woman could be. Just as I am a better man than I ever dreamed was possible. I used to think that when I first got sober that I was unfit. I didn't belong on the face of this earth. I'm no goddamn good and I should have never got here. After a while, I was sober for a while, I determined that the world's a better place because I'm sober. Then I come to the awareness that the world's a better place because I'm in it. You see, my release of judgment against me came when I was in my third step. I couldn't take my third step without accepting the forgiveness of God and forgiving myself. I found that the great reality is, in true fact, deep within. I go out once a year, pretty much on my motorcycle. I said I was sane, but not didn't say I wasn't crazy. I just started riding a motorcycle. I'm 72 years old. Old people don't learn easy. The reason I ride a motorcycle is because I had a yearning in my heart to go to the desert. And so I just go to the desert. This last trip I had was visiting the state of Arizona, all over the state of Arizona. And there was a theme that ran through my mind, a constant theme that many of you probably know of it or have heard of it. It says, "In Him I live and move and have my being." So I spent 9 days traveling through God's creation with the living consciousness of a loving God, seeing the beautiful things that He had for store for me to go down to Palm Springs and join my lovely bride. What I have found out in the last, I probably knew it all along, but the last year and a half, certainly sobriety is important. But another word for God is love. I love you. Oh God, I love you. Because I know who you are. You're children of my God, as I am. And I wouldn't have it any other way. Because you see, there's no life apart from God. There's no life apart from God. I lived in hell for 48 years. God is life. I'm alive. Therefore, we are that which He is. I love you. Thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart, allowing me to come here and express my love for you. Good night.